Section 5. What is Mahayana Buddhism? To the question which stands as the heading of this section, answer may be returned in a twofold manner. Firstly, by way of an enumeration of the general characteristics developed by the Mahayana in reaction against those Hinayana deviations from the spirit of the original teaching, which were summarised in the five charges preferred in the last section. Secondly, by way of an account of the teachings, which, in addition to the basic Buddhist doctrines and methods described in Chapter 1, were held in common by all schools and offshoots of the Mahayana. In this section, the subject will be dealt with in the first manner. The remaining sections of this chapter will be devoted to a discussion of it in the second manner. The Hinayana, being conservative and literal-minded, scholastic, one-sidedly negative in its conception of Nirvana and the Way, over-attached to the formal aspects of monasticism, and spiritually individualistic, the Mahayana, as a movement of reaction against the Hinayana, was naturally compelled to emphasise the importance of whatever qualities and characteristics were the exact opposite of these. It was therefore 1. Progressive and liberal-minded, caring more for the spirit than the letter of the scriptures, willing to write fresh ones whenever the need of recasting the outward form of the teaching arose. 2. More highly emotional and devotional in attitude, with a deeper understanding of the value of ritual acts, and 3. More positive in its conception of Nirvana and the Way. 4. While continuing to cherish the monastic ideal, it gave increased importance to a dedicated household life. And 5. It developed the altruistic aspect of Buddhism and preached the Bodhisattva ideal. Inasmuch as the account given in the preceding section of the general characteristics of the Hinayana constitutes at the same time a negative description of the characteristics of the Mahayana, knowledge of the former automatically throwing a partial illumination upon the latter, an examination of the above five distinguishing features of the great vehicle, as detailed as that which was accorded the first principal charges against the little vehicle, would be superfluous. Besides, the remaining sections of this work, since they treat exclusively of the Mahayana, are in a sense all illustrative of the facts which it is now the business of this section to establish. So, 1. Once again, the possibility of serious misunderstanding must be guarded against. And just as in the corresponding paragraph of the last section, we had to point out that the Hinayana was not accused of being unprogressive in the modern sense, so we must now insist that although characterising the Mahayana as progressive and liberal-minded, we do so only after injecting these terms with a distinctly Buddhist connotation. By the progressivism and liberalism of the great vehicle, no more and no less is meant than its constant awareness, its vivid realisation and effective recognition of the fact that the transcendental is ineffable, and that all possible conceptual formulations and verbal expressions possess in relation to it a merely symbolical significance. Says the Lord in the Lankavatara Sutra, Mahamati, words are not the highest reality, nor is what is expressed in words the highest reality. Why? Because the highest reality is an exalted state of bliss, and as it cannot be entered into by mere statements regarding it, words are not the highest reality. Mahamati, the highest reality is to be attained by the inner realization of noble wisdom. It is not a state of word discrimination. Therefore, discrimination does not express the highest reality. But though the indescribability of the state or reality designated by such words as Nirvana, Tathata, Shunyata, Dharmakaya and Chitta, and the elusiveness of perfect wisdom, is one of the favourite topics of Sanskrit Buddhist literature, especially of the Pranyaparamita group of texts, the anti-literalism of the Mahayana consists as much in the vigorousness and systematicality of its application of this truth as in the prolixness of its appreciation. Almost every important Mahayana sutra, while conscious of its own indispensability, is also instinct with a sense of its own inadequacy. Every doctrine is, as it were, window-like, transparent, inviting the eye to look not at it, but through it and beyond it into the heaven of pure consciousness, where the Sun of Truth, transcending the clouds of discrimination, shines with undimmed glory. Compassion springs up in the void as a lotus in the water, and all Mahayana expedients for the attainment of the Supreme Buddhahood, every one of which is wrought and devised by compassion, are saturated with the consciousness of their own relativity. The more emphatically a text enjoins upon us a certain practice, the more vigorously does it exhort us constantly to remember that from the transcendental viewpoint, the practice is quite meaningless. Indeed, we are sometimes even told that the success of the practice depends upon our realization of the impossibility of success in the ultimate sense. While one text, with typical exuberance of expression, declares that, relatively speaking, in Buddha lands numberless as the sands of the Ganges, countless Buddhas deliver for incalculable aeons discourses innumerable, another, with no less typical austerity, assures us that, in the absolute sense, from the night of his supreme enlightenment to the night of the final passing away, the Tathagata has not uttered even a single word. How different is such an attitude from that of the Hinayana? On the one hand, we find unbounded confidence in the spirit of the teaching, leading to a marvellous flexibility of the letter, to an opening up in all directions of ever wider and wider approaches and avenues to the truth. On the other, a slavish dependence on the letter of the teaching, resulting in an almost total evacuation of the spirit, in a gradual narrowing, culminating at last in a complete blockage, even of the path recognized as taught by the Buddha and professedly followed. Should there be for a Buddhist no choice save between sacrificing the spirit to the letter of the teaching on this side, or the letter to the spirit on that, we hope that we should have the strength to reject the former alternative in order to embrace the latter. Happily, though, modern scientific research, by enabling us to study side by side the Hinayana and the Mahayana, has spared us the pain of making so invidious a choice. The spirit of Buddhism, as transmitted by the Mahayana, can now be studied in the light of its letter, as preserved by the Theravada, and vice versa. An intelligent and informed Buddhist, though he may follow in practice, as indeed follow he must, the doctrines and methods of the particular line of Buddhist tradition best adapted to his individual requirements, can no longer regard as valid the claim of any school to the exclusive possession of the whole truth about Buddhism. Item 2. In the eyes of those to whom reason and emotion are, if not contradictories, at least inimical to each other, it is one of the paradoxes of the Mahayana that, while giving a much greater scope to the free play of emotion than the Hinayana, it is at the same time much more rigorously intellectual. This phenomenon may to some extent be accounted for by remembering that the Mahayana was, as we shall see more fully later on, not merely a sporadic movement of reaction against the Hinayana, but also a more or less systematic development of the whole body of early Buddhist teaching. Contrary to the received opinion, certain pages of the Pali Canon thrill with a quiet enthusiasm, or glow with a serene happiness, or flash out in dazzling ecstasy, while striking expressions of faith in and devotion to the person of the Buddha are by no means wanting. Like a vibration of a pitch too high to be perceived as sound by human ears, the very delicacy and refinement of the emotional element in the Pali scriptures, wholly free as it is from the turbidity and violence of ordinary human passion, has perhaps caused it to escape attention. At any rate, according to both Pali and Sanskrit Buddhist scriptures, reason and emotion, wisdom and faith, must be developed, not one-sidedly, but in perfect equilibrium. a completely harmonious development of the cognitive, cognitive, and affective aspects of personality is in fact necessary at each and every stage of the life spiritual. As a perusal of the Bodhicaryavatara of Shantideva will suffice to indicate, the fervent emotionalism of the Mahayana never went to the extreme of anti-intellectualism. Even the Jodo Shinshu, which professes to teach salvation by simple faith, does so against the background of a profound and subtle metaphysic. Though the emotionalism of the Mahayana stands in contrast to the one-sided scholasticism and rationalism of the Hinayana, it should never be forgotten that the Mahayana not only incorporated into its own teaching the bulk of Hinayana scholasticism, but also developed schools of philosophy which, for sharpness of dialectic, boldness of speculation, and sustained awareness of that which transcends philosophy, have rarely, if ever, been equalled in the world. Every emotion being of a triune nature, inasmuch as it may be directed towards an object inferior, equal or superior to the subject, we find taking place in Mahayana Buddhism a threefold development of emotion as compassion, karuna, love, maitri, and devotion, bhakti. Owing to the very nature of Buddhist thought, however, devotion and compassion, which are in a sense complementary, sprang up much more luxuriantly than love. The novice bodhisattva, for whose edification most of the Mahayana scriptures were intended, found himself occupying, as it were, an intermediate position. Below him, swept struggling along by the torrent of samsara, were untold millions of miserable worldly beings, while above, smiling and resplendent upon their lotus thrones, Buddhas and bodhisattvas innumerable rose tier upon tier to the zenith. Adoration for the latter, compassion for the former, were his dominating sentiments, the height and depth of his spiritual life. Love was a sentiment to be felt either between worldly beings, though their very worldliness would generally make them incapable of love, or between the enlightened members of the transcendental hierarchy. Since emotion, as we know it, can be felt not for things but only for persons, the development of devotion naturally led to a multiplication of the objects of devotion, namely of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so that we find in the Mahayana transcendental beings innumerable who are quite unknown to the teaching in its earlier form. Again, emotion naturally tending to seek an outlet in action, the sentiment of adoration, as its intensity increased, inevitably found expression in a variety of outward forms of worship. These forms, being inoculated with metaphysics, became possessed of a deep symbolical significance, and the ritualistic aspect of the Mahayana developed independence upon devotion as one of its conditions. The value of ritual acts in helping to induce certain correspondent states of consciousness was fully appreciated by the Mahayana, in consequence of which they made extensive use of supports of this kind. The Hinayanists, not feeling so strongly the devotional impulse, stopped short at ceremony and failed to make any contribution to the ritualistic aspect of Buddhism. In the Theravada as it exists today, however, especially in Sri Lanka, Thailand and Cambodia, the effect produced on the mind by the dignified and decorous proceedings of the Sangha is sometimes in nature strangely similar to, though feebler in intensity than, that of Mahayana ritual. But it should not be forgotten that whereas the more diffuse benefits of Theravada ceremonies are largely confined to members of the Sangha, Mahayana rituals are vehicles of a concentrated transcendental power available to all who are qualified by initiation for its reception. Item 3. Coming now to the third general characteristic of the Mahayana, its more positive conception of Nirvana and the way, we must again beware of identifying the teaching of the great vehicle with any one-sided or extreme position, merely because its emergence on the phenomenal plane was bound up with a movement of opposition to certain aspects of the Hinayana doctrine and discipline. That nirvana was ineffable was axiomatic for all schools. Consequently, all recognized, at least in theory, the impossibility of regarding positive statements about its essential nature as being more valid than negative ones, or vice versa. This is the position of both the Pali and Sanskrit scriptures, and if certain of the latter appear to be one-sidedly negative in their mode of expression, the appearance is superficial, being in reality due to their confirmed habit of negating even negation. Mahayana positivism is of two kinds, doctrinal and methodological. As we saw in Chapter 1, the Hinayana gradually became prey to the habit of regarding the negative characterizations of nirvana as being not descriptions but definitions, and as therefore possessing not a relative but an absolute validity. Against this dangerous tendency, the Mahayana entered a vigorous protest, maintaining that, from the standpoint of doctrine, all conceptual formulations of reality, whether positive or negative, were equally invalid. At the same time, it maintained that from the standpoint of method, positive formulations, being more easily understood and more attractive than negative ones, were generally of greater practical help to the average Buddhist. This dual standpoint was adopted by the followers of the Great Vehicle, because on the one hand they wanted to safeguard the profundity of the doctrine, and on the other to guarantee the amplitude of the method. Wisdom demanded that the positive should be defended against the encroachments of the negative indications of nirvana. Compassion, going a step further, pleaded that the positive indications, though admittedly no more valid in the ultimate sense than their negative counterparts, were much more efficacious as supporters of the spiritual life. Consequently, we have as the metaphysical background of Mahayana Buddhism the all-dominating conception of shunyata, or voidness, the state wherefrom all conceptions, including that of voidness itself, have been prescinded. Against this background of absolute, not relative, negation, stands out that rich efflorescence of positive conceptions which constitutes the methodological foreground of the Mahayana. First, we see abstract conceptions such as citta, or absolute consciousness, and mahasukha, or supreme bliss. Next, quasi-religious conceptions such as the Dharmakaya, the absolute person, wherein wisdom and compassion are united, not mathematically, but spiritually. After that, an innumerable host of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other divinities, all personifications of various stages of the path. And finally, legions of gods, demigods, guardian spirits, and so on, each of which embodies, at however low a level of phenomenal existence, some aspect of the teaching. These positive conceptions stand out against the omnipresent background of voidness, not as actors against the drop curtain of a stage, but rather as panes of glass of gradually increasing degrees of opaqueness might stand out against the sunlit blue of the sky. The light of the void shines in varying degrees of intensity through them all. Through the well-nigh perfect transparency of the most abstract positive conceptions, with hardly any diminution of its brilliance, through the more concrete conceptions with more, but through all to some extent, so that all, to the measure of their capacity, may serve as indications for practical spiritual purposes of that which none of them is able to express. Just as, in the case of the Hinayana, the conception of nirvana as nothing but the complete cessation of phenomenal existence led to a one-sidedly negative presentation of the way, so, in the case of the Mahayana, a more positive conception of reality, even though that conception was admitted to possess only a relative validity, led to the formulation of an ideal spiritual life, much more positive, and hence infinitely more inspiring, than any preached by the Hinayana. This was the famous Bodhisattva ideal, the ideal of absolute altruism on the highest transcendental plane, constituting the practical side of the teaching of all schools of Mahayana Buddhism. Owing to the unique importance of the Bodhisattva ideal, which has been truly described as the very heart of the Mahayana. We shall devote to it the whole of chapter 4. To this chapter the reader is therefore referred for further information. Item 4. Modern Theravadins often commit the mistake of thinking that Mahayanists gave increasing importance to a dedicated household life at the expense of the integrity of the monastic ideal and the purity of the monastic observance. One at times hears the absurd charge that Mahayanist monks have no morality in the technical Buddhist sense and that they do not observe the Vinaya. Though there are sections of the Mahayana Sangha against whom such charges might with justice be brought, they are no more true of Mahayana monks as a body than of their Theravadan counterparts. What is quite true, however, is that Mahayana bhikshus, we exclude the Jodo Shinshu clergy who are not members of the Sangha, do not attach so much importance as the Hinayanist to what we have called the formal aspects of monasticism. Morality for them is not merely a matter of keeping up appearances in the eyes of the lay public, as it so often is in Theravadin lands. This healthier, and of course much more truly orthodox attitude, the Mahayana owes largely to the influence of the Bodhisattva ideal. Once it has been admitted that a Bodhisattva may be either a monk or a layman, it becomes impossible to identify the spiritual life exclusively with a life of monasticism. The Buddha himself certainly did not do so, a fact which the following verse from the Pali Dhammapada should be sufficient to establish. Even though a man be richly attired, if he develops tranquility, is quiet, subdued and restrained, leading a holy life and abstaining from injury to all living beings, he is a Brahman, he is an ascetic, he is a bhikkhu. At the same time, the Mahayana refusal to regard the spiritual and monastic life as necessarily synonymous, being the result of an emphasis on the essence rather than the accidents of the disciple's career, in practice brought about not a weakening but a strengthening of the integrity of the monastic ideal in the Mahayana and helped to safeguard the purity of the monastic observance. Though, according to some authorities, the Bodhisattva may commit for the good of others actions generally regarded as sinful, statements of this kind must be regarded as upholding the supremacy of compassion rather than as being subversive of the moral order. Such Mahayana texts as deal with the subject, on the whole, demand of the Bodhisattva, who is also a member of the Sangha, as high a degree of asceticism as the Theravadin scriptures demand of the bhikkhu who aims at arahatship, the only difference being that for the novice bodhisattva, unlike the would-be arhat, the possibility of taking refuge in monastic formalism is, by the very nature of the Mahayana, precluded. Degeneration there may sometimes be in the Mahayana, no less than in the Theravada branch of the Sangha, but hypocrisy as one of the fine arts is unheard of there. Point 5. Just as spiritual individualism is the gravest charge that can be brought against the Hinayana, so does the unbounded altruism of the Mahayana bespeak its greatest praise. In place of the ideal of the pseudo-arhat, concerned primarily, if not exclusively, with his own emancipation from suffering, the great vehicle preaches the incomparable ideal of the profoundly wise and infinitely compassionate Bodhisattva, the great being who, in his eagerness to show to others the way to nirvana, is willing to sacrifice his own prospects of salvation. Yet it should not be supposed that because they took up a position diametrically opposite to that of the Hinayanists, the Mahayanists therefore fell into the trap of committing the diametrically opposite error. Speaking conventionally, individual beings do exist, and to talk of gaining enlightenment for oneself or of helping others to gain it, are therefore, on the level of conventional truth, both quite valid modes of expression. Harm is done only when we begin thinking that such statements are true absolutely. Spiritual individualism of the Hinayana type developed partly because certain groups of early Buddhists, insisted upon interpreting the Buddha's exhortations to self-effort and personal experience of the truth in a grossly literal manner. But the Mahayanists, adhering firmly to both doctrine and method, taught that although from the standpoint of compassion the Bodhisattva should resolve to emancipate all beings, from the standpoint of wisdom he should at the same time reflect that in the absolute sense no beings exist. By means of a fearless acceptance of contradictory propositions of this kind did the Mahayana safeguard itself against misunderstandings such as those to which the more literal-minded and rationalistic Hinayana so easily fell prey. Should we wish to parallel the four chief factors responsible for the rise of Hinayana individualism with four factors which, though neither historical sequence nor logical connection can be claimed for them, undoubtedly played an important part in the emergence of Mahayana altruism, it may be said in brief that the great vehicle was 1. Better able to resist the gravitational pull already mentioned. This was no doubt because it 2. Was much more keenly aware of the purely relative value and symbolical significance of words and concepts in relation to the absolute. That, moreover, 3. It gave a much more prominent place in the spiritual life to emotion, thus rendering possible the maximum development of compassion. And 4. Attached at least as much importance to the personal example of the Buddha as to his precepts. Having summarized the main points of divergence between the Hinayana and the Mahayana, it must now be our endeavor to achieve a wider and more synthetic view of the relations between the two schools. One point has already emerged with sufficient distinctness. The teachings of the great and little vehicles are not mutually exclusive as regards either doctrine or method, and there is sufficient evidence to show that in ancient and medieval India, followers of various branches of both schools were sometimes found dwelling together as members of a single co-fraternity. Though the Hinayana repudiated as heretical the distinctively Mahayana teachings, as does the Theravada to this day, a number of them were too useful to be ignored and were in the end tacitly absorbed by the more conservative school. The Mahayana, on the other hand, had recourse to the much bolder expedient of incorporating the Hinayana wholesale into its own teachings. Tibetan Buddhists even today speak of their faith as the Triyana Tibetan Buddhism, the three yanas being in this case not those described in section 3, but the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Tantrayana, envisaged as the successively higher stages of a single path. Yet it would be a mistake to think that what we have termed the distinctively Mahayana teachings were altogether different from or discontinuous with the teachings incorporated from Hinayana sources. Savastivadin and Vinayavadin scholasticism constitutes one continuous line of development, and however unorthodox certain Mahayana doctrines may appear in the eyes of modern Theravadins, all of them can be discovered in germinal form in the pages of the Theravada scriptures. Even the five general characteristics by means of which we have distinguished the Mahayana from the Hinayana could be illustrated with instances derived from the oldest strata of the Pali Canon. The Mahayana is a movement, not of innovation, but of development and unfoldment. Hardly astonishing, therefore, is the fact that more than one historian of Buddhism has found the similitude of a plant or a tree particularly appropriate. The Mahayana is related to the original teaching as a flower to its parent germ. And as the flower produces fresh seed, so does the Mahayana contain within itself the possibility of perpetually renaissance spiritual life. The Hinayana literalism against which the Mahayanists invade may be compared to the husk which, while it protects the seed in the early stages of its growth, must be burst asunder and cast aside if the germinating life within is to find room for development. Whatever the verdict of historians may be, in the spiritual sense, the Mahayana is not a departure from, but rather a return to the teaching of the Buddha. The Mahayanists themselves have, in fact, always believed that the distinctive tenets of their school, far from being developments of or additions to the original Buddha word, were actually taught by the Lord's own golden mouth. This point of view may be expressed in two different ways. According to the first, which is the account traditionally accepted by Mahayanists, the Sanskrit sutras as we have them today are nothing less than the direct utterance of the Shakyamuni himself. Some might have been delivered earlier in his career, others later, but all are to be fitted in with the recorded events of his earthly existence, and all to find a place in the catalogue of historical discourses. The second way of understanding the Mahayana point of view has been hit upon by certain modern Japanese Buddhist scholars and is much more sophisticated. According to this interpretation, though the Buddha cannot be regarded as the author of the Sanskrit sutras, the distinctively Mahayana doctrines embodied in these works were first taught by him to the more advanced among his disciples, who then transmitted them esoterically from generation to generation until the time was ripe for making them public. By the publication of these hitherto carefully guarded traditions is of course meant the composition of the Sanskrit sutras, which, though they may not reproduce with stenographic fidelity the ipsissima verba of the Buddha, at least preserve the substance of authentic teachings. As expressed in the traditional way, the Mahayana point of view is quite unacceptable. The Sanskrit sutras are unmistakably the work of a period much later than that of the Buddha. But as interpreted by the Japanese scholars, it contains an important element of truth. And in this form, though difficult to prove, has at least the advantage of being impossible to disprove. The least that can be said for the Mahayanists is that they are undoubtedly right in claiming to be in the direct line of spiritual descent from the Buddha, though they must be understood as having transmitted not this or that doctrine in the sense of a more or less elaborate conceptual formulation of transcendental verities, but rather that to which all such formulations pertain and point, namely the Buddha's own experience of enlightenment. With the preservation of this experience, the Mahayanists were, from the very beginning of their career as an independent school, chiefly concerned. The principal reason for their descent from Hinayana literalism being their conviction that it rendered enlightenment impossible of attainment. This descent naturally sought to justify itself in criticism. But the main object of Mahayana criticism was not the doctrines and methods of the Hinayana tradition, but rather the attitude which the Hinayanists took up towards them and the manner in which they interpreted them. In fact, as we have already seen, instead of rejecting the Hinayana teachings, the Mahayanists incorporated them into their own tradition where they may still be found. Such criticisms of the Hinayana as occur in the Mahayana sutras are therefore to be understood as directed not against the actual teachings of the Buddha as preserved, for instance in the suttas of the Theravada Pali Canon, so much as against the one-sided interpretations which had arisen in certain ancient schools, especially among the Savastivadins. Indeed, though the substance of the Mahayana criticism still holds good of certain vociferous and violent groups claiming to represent the modern Theravada, the only surviving Hinayana school, it is not at all applicable to what appears to be the oldest strata of the Vinayapitaka and Suttapitaka of the Theravada Tipitaka. Mahayana and Theravada, when correctly interpreted, are much closer to each other than is generally imagined, a truth to which some at least among the followers of both schools now seem to be awakening, especially in Japan and Sri Lanka, to both of which countries must be ascribed the merit of endeavouring to achieve a more synoptic view of Buddhism. Disastrous as Hinayana literalism undoubtedly is, it should not be thought that liberalism is without its dangers. Eventually, after having flourished in the land of its birth for more than 1500 years, the Mahayana carried liberalism to extremes and exalted the spirit above the letter of the teaching to such an extent that the latter was almost lost sight of, and the Dharma deprived, at least on the mundane plane, of its distinctive individuality. This was one of the factors responsible for the decline of Buddhism in India and its ultimate disappearance from its native soil. Hinayana and Mahayana may be regarded as representing two tendencies, one centripetal and the other centrifugal, in the teaching of the Buddha. While the first prevents disintegration, the second preserves from petrification. In the history of Buddhism, we see the constant interplay of these two tendencies or forces, each of which exists in a subordinate manner within the sphere of influence of the other. As the existence of the solar system depends upon the maintenance of a perfect balance between the centripetal and centrifugal forces impelling the heavenly bodies of which it is composed, so the very existence of Buddhism depends upon the maintenance of an absolute equilibrium between the literalizing and the liberalizing influences which the Hinayana and the Mahayana respectively exert over the doctrines and methods constituting the Dharma. This fact the Mahayana realizes with much greater vividness than the Hinayana, so that, although historically speaking the Mahayana is opposed to the Hinayana, doctrinally it includes it. The Hinayana, which in the modern context means the Theravada, on the contrary, generally regards the Mahayana as a degeneration of the original teaching, of which it claims to be the sole custodian, and the distinctively Mahayana doctrines and methods are repudiated as corruptions of the pure Dharma. But as Dr. Konze says, to regard all later Buddhist history as a record of the degeneration of an original gospel is like regarding an oak tree as a degeneration of an acorn. The most reasonable course seems to take the Mahayana's own view of its relation to the enlightenment of the Buddha on the one hand, and to the Hinayana on the other, and to regard its distinctive teachings as legitimate, helpful, and indeed necessary developments. What exactly these developments were, it will now be our business to inquire.